As we light our chalice this morning, I offer these words from Laurel Sheridan. Take from life its coals, not its ashes. Fan the flames of love and justice. Join hands and hearts in common endeavor. And there can be no limit to what we can achieve together. A couple of weeks ago, I spent the week in California with colleagues, ministers, mostly that I had known. There were 450 ministers, but most of the time I stuck to the people I knew, friends I had gone to school with that I met 9 years ago. And at one point we took some time to reconnect because we hadn't seen each other in years. Some of these people still hadn't met my two-year-old. So we hadn't seen each other since he was born. And he was napping, and I've come to learn you don't wake up a napping two-year-old. And so we just let him sleep, and we tried to meet outside our hotel room and just kind of let him do his thing. And so since they hadn't met him yet, they asked, well, what is Elijah like? That was an interesting question. He was approaching his second birthday, and I had to stop and think, how do I describe this little person to these people who haven't met him, who don't know his daily ins and outs quite the same way I do? So I tried to step back and figure out what it was like. I told a story that I've told some of you in various ways, and I'll share now, a story that really, really made me fall in love with this kid. Not long ago, I brought him home from daycare. And every day I do, I go through the same litany of questions, which I'm sure probably will annoy him at some point. It did me as a kid. But my mother asked me the same litany of questions, so I ask him, how was your day at school? What did you do? Did you play with this? Did you do this? So I asked about his friends. Did you see Abby? Did you see Kyle? Did you? And after I said, did you see Abby? He said, uh-huh. I said, okay. I said, Abby, cry. Abby cried, night-night. Abby cried at night-night? Uh-huh. It was amazing to me that this kid was trying to tell me that one of his friends, one of his friends was crying at nap time when she wanted to sleep. The next day, same thing went with a different kid. This kid cried when it was time to eat. I asked the kid's name. He said, cry. Uh-huh. Eat. Eat. So he cried when it was time to eat? Uh-huh. It amazed me that this little kid was trying to tell me something of his own experience. I mostly was asking the question for myself because I liked to enjoy that give and take. But the truth is, he had something to share of his day. I found myself getting into the same habits that I so often decry of just looking past the person I'm trying to talk to. And what I told my friends was that I love the kid because he reminded me that he's not just my son, but that he's Elijah. And that 20 years from now, he'll be off doing his own thing, living a life that I can't predict, that I can't change or control. And it'll be amazing and hard, but that's what I love. Some of the knowing parents in the room laughed, those who have almost teenagers at this point, those who had two-year-olds when I first met them. Yeah, I know what it's like when they grow up and change and make their own decisions. You didn't think it'd be like that when they were about to be born, did you? No, I didn't. I wasn't sure what it would be like at all before birth, when he was still just something in my mind. It was hard for me to imagine because he wasn't a person and because I didn't take the time to relate to him. And so I spent the week of his second birthday and the week being with colleagues thinking about what it means to relate, to learn about another's life and to live with others. Later in the week, I went down to the beach and saw at this beautiful beach with blue waves. I wanted to take pictures because that's one of my hobbies, and I got my camera out, ready to do it. The camera had died. I was disappointed, right? In fact, I started pouting much like a child because here I was ready to do this. And in fact, on the horizon, I could see water spouting up in the air. And so I asked my partner what she thought that was. And she said, I saw that this morning. I'm pretty sure those are the whales. People are out on tours whale watching. And of course it made sense. And so we did some reading on some of the placards and those were the humpback whales. And I thought about what it was like to be so close and yet so far from this huge thing. that I didn't understand or experience. And the human experience of the ocean is already interesting, and then we relate to these whales, and we think we know them because we're similar, but they're different. The image of the whale is one that often occupies and captures our attention. There's Moby Dick, there's Free Willy. In fact, do you still have the book, Lori? So I wrote this in my sermon, and first service I just skipped it, and then Lori had this book beside her. It's the story of Pinocchio, and I kid you not, Pinocchio is inside the whale. Do you remember this from the movie or from the story? So I forget exactly how or why, but Pinocchio gets swallowed by a whale. It's awesome in this pop-up book, thank you. And then I want to tell you, so I saw the whales, and I'm thinking about my kid and how I didn't know him before he was born that well, and it made me think of Jonah and the whale. Before I tell you much about Jonah, I made this disclaimer in the first service because I thought it was important. I am not comparing my child being in the stomach of my wife to a whale. That is just clear, just not at all. I'm just saying there was a barrier. He was far, you know, person living in a different thing. Yeah, okay. So she's aware that we're talking about this today too, by the way, but that's not what I'm saying because that gets dicey, right? So Jonah and the whale, how many of you remember this story? Wow, way more of you than I thought. I don't even need to tell it to most of you, but Jonah is one of the shorter books in the Bible, so I'll tell you. If you attended Sunday school, you might remember this. So, and I always like doing this. What do you remember of Jonah and the whale? Anyone, just shout it out.
He didn't want to go on the mission that God was sending
him. Didn't want to go on the mission that God was sending him. Anyone else? God punished him by doing what?
Having a whale eat him.
Right? So what else do you remember? Anything else?
Eventually he got released.
So what I love, talking with this story in religious education with UU third and fourth graders, like the reading I shared earlier where the woman's talking about love and the rational parts and the scientific parts, our third and fourth graders often love to attack the story from a scientific perspective and to point out that, you know, teeth would get in the way and acid and that the whale is not going to let the person come back up and all of this. It's interesting how often our mind goes to explaining, nope, that can't happen. But the story, of course, is just this great myth. So sit down with the metaphor some. So Jonah thinks he's told to do something. God calls him to do it, doesn't want to do it, runs away. For me, the metaphor is he's trapped and he feels isolated. There's chaos all around. So he gets actually swallowed by the whale, which I forgot, because he's like on a boat and there are just waves crashing and he's actually putting everyone else's life at risk. And they're like, guy, why are we getting punished because you're the one messing up? So then they throw him overboard and he's swallowed. Most people, myself included, stop paying attention to the story pretty much after the whale spits him out. I recall that he then goes and does whatever it is God wants him to do, and I didn't really care much more beyond that. Because I think, you know, what more can there be? If that happens to you, that's the status update. That's, you know, that's the first line of any obituary you get after that is like, I got swallowed by a whale, and I live to tell about it. The story does go on. Does anyone know any, like, more? Andrew's not included, because he might, actually. So anyone other than Andrew know what else happens into Jonah? Martin, no more. Martin's banned, too, from answering. Oh, AJ, you're going to give a guess. All right, what you got? Come on. All right. So this is, it's all true. You're all right. Well done. If I had candy to give you, I would. So he goes. He decides to give Nineveh the message, and Nineveh listens, right? And that's the most amazing thing at first. And then, of course, he just gets angry because he says, you know, I went through all this trouble. The boat, there were waves that were crashing. I got swallowed by a whale. I actually decided to do it, and the people repented, and now everything's okay. And Jonah is pissed. He's angry because the people changed and now there won't be hellfire and damnation, which he predicted. Perhaps it should have been obvious to the readers, but it wasn't, at least to me. When he's alone and isolated and scared, when he's in the whale, He talks about those people. That's his prayer to God. I will go talk to those people. And he talks about the good stuff that he does and he will do a lot. He uses the word I an awful lot in prayer. But he doesn't really see the worth and dignity in others. So even though he's reconnected with society physically, his soul isn't really restored. And he never learns to love the people he goes to speak to. So when he goes to the town, he says, "You know what? Maybe if you change your ways, compassion will be granted." But he refuses to recognize that perhaps he has ways that need to be changed as well. This often makes me think of the passage from the New Testament in Matthew chapter 7, where the reader is asked, "Why do we worry about the speck in our own eye or in the neighbor's eye when there's a log in our own eye?" Jonah's so wrapped up in changing everyone else that he gets angry when they actually do it. So God, at the end of the story of Jonah, tries to teach him a lesson. God grows a plant, a tree, basically, which Jonah becomes super attached to. It's hot, the tree provides shade, and God, being miraculous, grows it overnight. And then, in God's infinite wisdom or vengeance, whatever you want to call it, God kills the tree. It's gone. No more shade, no more coolness. And Jonah, still suffering from his, like, anger stuff, gets angry. He says he'd rather die than live, because now the tree is gone. "I went, I preached your message, the people fixed it, I don't know what you want, the tree's gone, kill me now." Sort of. And to me, here it gets interesting. Because God points out that Jonah cares so much about this tree that he did not plant, that he did not tend, he did not grow, the tree has lived all of one day. And if Jonah could care so much about something that he had only just met, only just experienced, just gotten to know, then of course there should be compassion and love for human life, for relationships. God says, "What do you think I feel towards the people of Nineveh? There's so many more of them, and how we are together, and they've lived for so much longer." Here is at least one part of where I imagine Jonah went wrong. There are lots of different places I think he went wrong, but one of them is that once he got out of the whale, once he went to Nineveh, he went to the town, and my guess is he did not sit down across from the table, either at a bar or a coffee shop or at a temple. He didn't sit down, and he didn't ask a question, let alone 36. The Arthur Aaron study and the Mandy Catrone reading tells us that relationships are born out of mutuality and out of curiosity. Jonah, I'm sure, felt like he didn't have the time to sit down to ask people questions or to get to know their life stories. I'm sure that Jonah felt he had this calling, that he felt empowered to simply share the good news or the right news, come hell or high water. In fact, he kind of wanted the hell or high water to come to prove he was right. He didn't want to meet them. I love this line from Annie Dillard, who says, "We are here to abet creation and to witness it, to notice each thing so that each thing gets noticed. Together we notice not only each mountain, not only each stone on the beach, but each other's beautiful face and complex nature, so that creation need not play to an empty house." Jonah noticed none of that. When he failed to learn about the people, to see those beautiful faces and complex natures, he simply labeled them as evil and wrong, and those people, they did wrong. And in so doing, he committed the gravest sin in the story, the sin of brokenness, of disconnection. Love doesn't just happen. More than a feeling, love is a choice. And when we choose to see past people, because our own righteousness tells us to, or because we're hurt or scared, that's when we're doing something off course. At least in my life, there's nothing so important that it ought to come before relationships, because it's in building those relationships that I learn the words and the lines and the pages and the chapters of stories of the people around me. It's out of those stories that I help to summon the sacred with you. In writing about her experiment with love and asking those 36 questions of her now partner, Mandy Cantone writes, "I now see that the story isn't about us. It's about what it means to bother to know someone, which is really a story about what it means to be bothered to be known." Here we sit together in a sanctuary apart from the rest of the world, in a holy place dedicated to the idea that we will safely join together in seeking and serving the world in community. Might I suggest that we do all of that in love? Not the saccharine sweet love that comes from speaking nice words without meaning. One of the questions that is in Dr. Aaron's story is, say three nice things about the person, but not just three nice things you might say to a stranger. You must go deeper. So we are here not to complete the superficial love that we offer people we don't really know, because in this space we share such holy things, our deepest joys and sorrows, our fears and regrets. This real love, our deep love, requires an intimacy and a trust, a vulnerability, a willingness to ask hard questions, to speak hard truths and share silence together. In this, we learn not just about one another, but about ourselves. We start to figure out our deepest joys and regrets, those fears and dreams, and we see them in the eyes of others. In so doing, we learn how to care for ourselves, for one another, and we build community. That's the love, the real deep love that so many of us long for. We recognize it's an imperfect love. That's all any of us can be, but that's what we can create here. It's a place where we can and will run away from our calling, but return to it eventually. It's a place where we're held in love even though we're imperfect beings, but we're called to be our best selves in kindness and in love. A number of years ago, I took a couples therapy course as part of my seminary program. And I like to joke that my wife and I started couples therapy day one from when we started a relationship, because we took this course together before we were ever a couple. It was an interesting basis for being in a relationship. We thought it'd give us some ground rules to work from. It helps and it hurts. We know all the tricks and tools that might come with couples therapy and in relationships. A big part of this couples therapy course talked about the Gottman Institute in Chicago. That's where I went to school. And this Gottman Institute studies couples have for a long time and how they are successful. John Gottman, who's still living, says that within a 96% certainty, he can predict if your relationship will stay together or not. I don't know if it's true, but this is his claim. In large part, he can determine that through things like kindness. Julie Gottman, his wife, says kindness doesn't mean that we don't express our anger, but it informs how we choose to express our anger. We can either throw spears at our partner, or we can explain why we're hurt and angry through kindness. Further, the Gottman Institute talks about just how we relate on a daily basis, and it talks about partnership, but I want you to think not just in terms of lovers, partners, but children, parents, neighbors, fellow members at Brew. Here's a story from the Gottman Institute. It comes from a piece called Masters of Love from Emily Smith. She writes, throughout the day, Gottman says that partners would make requests for connection called bids. They'd make bids to one another. For example, one partner is a bird enthusiast, and they'd say, "Oh, look, there's a goldfinch flying across the yard. Look at that beautiful bird." The partners are not just commenting on the bird here. He's requesting a response from his partner, a sign of interest or support, hoping they'll connect, however momentarily, over this one thing. Now the other partner has a choice. They can either respond by turning toward or away from the husband. Through the bird bid might seem minor or silly, it actually reveals a lot about the health of a relationship. The husband thought the bird was important enough to bring it up in conversation. And the question is whether or not his partner recognizes it and respects it. So people who turned toward their partners in the study respond by engaging, showing interest and support in the bid. Those who didn't just keep on doing what they're doing. They either ignore their partner, they stay on the phone, they read the newspaper, watch TV, or they might be more hostile. They might say, stop interrupting me. I'm watching TV. I'm reading. So their studies, and they've done these over time, show that couples who divorce over six-year periods turn towards one another a third of the time. Only one in three times, if someone says, hey, look at that car, isn't that cool? Yeah, sure, whatever, that's great. You know, they turn towards it one out of three times, not the rest. The couples who stay together over 6 years do it 9 out of 10 times. So yes, they mess up, they screw up, they forget about it ever so often. We're called to be imperfect beings because we are. But most of the time, they do what they can to meet their partner where they are. It's this practicing kindness that we're called to do, not just because we want ourselves to be loved, but we want to love other people for who they are. In many ways, we think of this as the golden rule, right? We might turn to people because when we want something, they want to respond to us. But it goes beyond that. It goes beyond loving them because we want love, but possibly to loving them because they are. And isn't that what each person deserves? In many ways, this is an imperative lesson in our world right now. I believe it's a moral lesson for us. It goes back even to Kant in his categorical imperative. He writes, act in such a way that we treat humanity, whether it's about us or others, never as a means to an end, but always as an end. I'm a big proponent in Martin Buber's I and Thou theology, which is to say that people aren't objects. That when we look into one another's eyes, we should see the humanity in the soul. And finally, Dr. King. Dr. Martin Luther King referenced this as he spoke of agape, a Greek word for a holy love, a sort of religious love going beyond friendship or maternal love, a word that could best describe beloved community, something like we create here. King wrote this, and I tweaked it a little bit to change some of the gendered language. King writes, when we rise to agape, the greatness of it is that you love every person, not for your sake, but for their sake. So our charge this morning, the day after Valentine's Day, we have a whole year to love before the red hearts come back, the roses are back around. Hopefully we can find ways each and every day to ask questions, whether of our children, our lovers, or maybe just ourselves. Our charge is to love each and every person, starting with ourselves and those beside us, reaching out to the stranger, to those in need, and yes, even to those we consider our enemies. And may we learn to love each person as they are, not as we wish they were. And in so doing, may our community and may all communities be saved from destruction. Amen, and blessed be.